Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The new book by Joyce Carol Oates is a novel based on the Tawana Brawley incident of the 1980s. Before you ask why Tawana Brawley, why now? The choice of topic is consistent with Ms. Oates' history of writing stories about class and racial tensions, power, adolescence, and sexual abuse. As far back as 1970, she won the National Book Award for her novel Them, which dealt with race and class conflicts in a mid-20th century ghetto neighborhood in Detroit. In fact, Ms. Oates says this new novel is strongly linked to that one. The new book by Joyce Carol Oates is called The Sacrifice. Ms. Oates, thank you very much for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
Can you begin by saying why you decided to write a book now linked to one you wrote 45 years ago?
Well, I always wanted to revisit the scene of Them, which is basically an urban situation of sudden unrest and what we call civic disturbance, or riots, as they're called in the tabloid papers. I wanted to write about white racism and the legacy of hurt and injury and outrage and insult that just keeps coming. I finished the novel in January 2013, which is, you know, well before Ferguson and the Eric Garner scandal. And so the novel, in a coincidental way, seems very timely.
Indeed. But why then write a book today, or why before Ferguson and Eric Garner did it occur to you to write a book about, of all things, the Tawana Brawley incident, or a novel based on it?
Well, if you read the special report of the grand jury, the New York State grand jury, in the Tawana Brawley case, you'd see that my novel's fiction. I'm not writing about that case at all. It's suggested by the phenomenon, particularly the media circus, the sort of controversy that swirled. It's suggested by that situation, but the actual novel is not about her.
Right. But the press release for the book starts right out by saying that it's a story based on the old Tawana Brawley incident. And you say on your website that you read the report of the grand jury as part of your research for this. So you were trying to draw some lessons from that real-life incident to tell a story that I guess you felt could be, besides a good story, instructive to us in some way, yes?
Well, the point is that my novel is not about that situation.
Yes.
In real life, Tawana Brawley was lying. It was a hoax. She wasn't raped, she wasn't beaten, she wasn't in terror of her life. My novel's about a girl, a black girl of 14, who is beaten, she has been raped, she is in terror of her life. I'm writing about a situation that's much more prevalent, much more realistic. In fact, many rape victims never even come forward. They don't acknowledge they've been raped, particularly if this is particularly in a neighborhood or in a family situation where there's a great fear for further recrimination against her. So I'm writing about the situation that the Tawana Brawley case seemed to be about, but literally was not. And I think that my version of this phenomenon of a black girl being brutalized, I think that is much more exemplary and representative of what really happens. The Tawana Brawley case was a fluke. It's like one in a million.
What does the title of the book, The Sacrifice, refer to?
Well, originally when I started writing the novel, I was going to write very much about the white policeman, the young rookie policeman who commits suicide. I was going to write about him, and the chapter called The Good Son is about him, and about his family, particularly his younger sister, and how they dealt with his death. And then about 2 weeks after he died, his name was taken. He was sort of appropriated from the newspaper by the people who wanted to use him to exploit his name, accusing him of having been one of the rapists of the girl. I mean, this actually happened. So I began with him as a kind of sacrifice. The novel's really about white racism and how it hurts everybody. Virtually everybody in the novel is part of the sacrifice, the whole community. I think when you are white, you imagine that you're not being hurt by white racism because it doesn't directly affect you. But in reality, we're all connected. and the racism exemplified by the brutality of the white police in these neighborhoods in which people are more or less captive, that hurts everybody.
And yet the Tawana Brawley case from real life has been referred to in the news quite a bit this year because of many police officers in New York City being alienated from Mayor de Blasio as a result of the mayor's close relationship with Al Sharpton. The fact that someone in law enforcement was falsely accused in the Brawley affair has made Sharpton a pariah to police officers, and they don't like the fact that in the news media there's so much discussion about abusive police and not enough discussion about when Sharpton's name comes up, at least, the fact that a police officer could be subject to false accusation. Did you give that thought as you were writing the book?
Well, Al Sharpton's not in my novel. I have a character somewhat like him, and then there are fictitious characters also. Now, Al Sharpton is a very controversial and, I think, special case. In a novel, a character like him is what we call a trickster. He's somebody in opposition to the establishment. He's a gadfly. He's very annoying. He doesn't exactly cross the line into behaving criminally, but maybe he does, you know. He's a character in a novel we can recognize as a trickster figure. Now, in real life, there was, of course, Al Sharpton, who emerged vis-a-vis Mayor Giuliani. So you have a white mayor who never, ever, ever criticized the police, no matter how many people they killed, how many people they brutalized, or with their stop-and-frisk policies, how many people they humiliated. I mean, maybe, you know, thousands of people over the years. I don't think one can compare anything that Al Sharpton has done to some of these other things. He's never murdered anyone in a chokehold. Al Sharpton never shot anyone in the back or anyone with his hands raised in the air. So it's ridiculous.
Joyce Carol Oates, my guest on WNYC, her new novel is called The Sacrifice. I saw on your website you wrote that your research for this book included reading the 1968 report of the National Advisory Committee on Civil Disorders, the famous Kerner Commission report that followed the urban riots or civil disturbances of the 1960s. What struck you about revisiting the Kerner Commission report after all these years?
Well, I have to say that because I lived in Detroit in 1967, at the time of the riot, what is called the riot, and I lived only about two blocks away from some of the looting and burning, and we heard sirens. We were sort of barricaded in our house, just hoping that we'd get through it. That experience was so astonishing, and at the time it was terrifying. But like many novelists, I wanted to understand the context. So I started reading about it as soon as I could, but I didn't really have access at the time. I wrote a novel called Them, which focuses on a white family and the virtually no black people in the novel. So I always wanted to go back and revisit that world of 1967, 1968, and then bringing it up to date to a city like Newark, New Jersey. The city in my novel is a fictitious city, but it's like a smaller version of Newark. And reading these reports and other books on the subject, you spend a good deal of time reading about eyewitnesses or people who had been beaten or terrified by the police, black witnesses, people talking about seeing others shot down in the street, and people talking about basically surviving the situation. So there are many, many first-person witness reports, and that is what particularly strikes me as a novelist, people speaking in their own voices.
Listeners, any phone calls for Joyce Carol Oates, either about her new book, The Sacrifice, or what we're discussing right here, right now, or something from her body of work? Oates fans, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You also consulted the official New York State grand jury report on the Tawana Brawley case from 1988, as you said. I'm curious what struck you about that, reading it with maybe only a more casual familiarity with it that you might have had from the news. I don't know, of course, how familiar you were with it, but I'm curious, in doing research for this novel, what struck you about reading the actual official grand jury report?
Well, it's very interesting. I actually have it with I think I have it with me right here. It's very interesting because it's very simple language, and obviously the grand jury spent a long time, and maybe there are thousands of pages. I have no idea what the transcript is, but the final report is very clear. There were no injuries. There was no rape. There was no beating. There was no this. There was no that. Basically, it was a complete fabrication. What I was struck by is living in the area, living in New Jersey at that time and reading about it in the New York Times particularly, I was struck by how the media seized upon what would seem to have been, I would think, most reporters must have been skeptical and editors must have wondered, but what seemed to have been probably an invented story got so much media attention and just became sort of astonishingly magnified. Now, why did that happen? So I look at that in the novel. But I have to say that my novel is not really about a criminal. It's not a criminology novel or sociology. It's basically about a family. It's particularly about a mother and daughter. There's a stepfather and there's some other characters. But it's about people. It's not about these, you know, we've been focusing on impersonal subjects in this conversation. But the novel is really about actual people.
What conclusions did you come to about why the New York Times might have been so credulous at first?
Well, it wasn't just the New York Times. It began sort of slowly. In the neighborhood, it was sort of known there was kind of a rumor that this girl had been terribly mistreated by the police, and it was just sort of a neighborhood rumor. And then it was seized upon by a character like but not identical to Eric Shopton. He started holding press conferences, and that began in a small way, and then it got larger, and then, you know, one thing led to another. Maybe the tabloid papers took it up first, and then the more respectable newspapers realized it was a huge subject, and I suppose they felt they could at that point and should cover it. And looking at what the media in the beginning, I think, inflamed the situation, but then later on the media maybe helped to expose it. So media, it's like a double-edged sword. You know, first the media may inflate something, but then the media can be used to investigate it in a cooler way and to look into it. But my novel is mostly about the people.
Yeah.
And as I said, I wanted to show how white racism leads to violence within a family in a neighborhood like this. And how people are, if they're divested of the humanity, you know, that they behave in ways that are reckless and unfortunate. And I did want to write about a girl who lashes out, who isn't just going to roll over and die after she's been sexually mistreated and beaten. Instead of just becoming, say, mute and depressed, she does lash out in a reckless way, and it precipitates all this tragedy.
Also about the people. You're right that this story is partly about the primal decisions we all make to protect those we love. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, yes. Well, I can't talk too much about it because it gives away the secret of the novel, which is not the same thing as what actually happened. I mean, the Tawana Browder case has been written about many, many, many times. And I'm really not making any comment on that in my novel because my characters are different people.
No spoilers from the author. Erin in Midland Park. You're on WNYC with Joyce Carol Oates. Hi, Erin.
Hi, Brian. I love your show, and thank you. I just would like to say I am a huge fan of Joyce Carol Oates, and thank you for having me on. I read your novel, Them, a couple months ago, and I just was struck by the correlations between what was going on back in the late 60s, early 70s, forgive me, I don't quite remember the exact dates, and what's going on today. And thank you very much. I'll take your response offline. Thanks.
Thank you.
Do you understand the question?
Well, I'm not sure that there's a question, but it was a very, very nice remark. And I finished this novel in January 2013, so it's really before the Ferguson and Eric Garner case and many others. So it was just sort of coincidental. But I think we've just always had police brutality and cover-ups. And what is so alarming to us is the failure of any accountability. The police seem to be able to do virtually anything. They have such a strong union, you can't criticize them without them getting very angry.
I'm curious about to follow up on Aaron's call, the evolution of your own thought or observations about race and class. When you look back on your novel, Them, written in the late 60s, do you think you got it in certain ways but missed it in others, or see anything differently now with the wisdom of more experience? I'm fishing here, but curious about how you might see the evolution of your own thinking.
Well, that novel was about a family also. It starts off with a woman named Loretta Wendell, and then we look at, as time goes on, you know, chapters go by, she has children and then a brother and a sister, and they become the focus of the novel. It's a white family. If I had brought in a black family, it would have been a different novel, a much longer novel, and it wouldn't have been the novel that I wrote. So in a way, that's, you know, it's not realistic. But I did want to revisit that atmosphere of a large city that's under siege.
I think it's something that's also very contemporary in the public discourse, this idea that white people need to talk more about whiteness in the context of race in America, not just put the focus on black this and black that, but we need to talk about what it means to be white in America.
Well, that's true. And when we talk about for instance, NYPD and the Albuquerque Police Department and other police departments that seem to be behaving without any accountability, we really have to recall that it isn't just black people who are the objects of their the brutality. They also beat up and murder homeless people and mentally ill people who may be white. So it isn't just a race situation. It's more class. It's more like economic class.
Jack in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Brian. Thank you very much. Joyce Carol Oates, you are my favorite living author. I read and reread you, and you're a constant source of inspiration to me as an artist. I have a question. How can you plumb the depths of darkness and despair as you do over and over again and not let it affect your everyday life, or does it?
Thank you. That's a very interesting question. I think because it's a formal structure of language where I have a novel as a form. I know the ending. The ending may be stronger. It may show people who have been brutalized, who have been terrified, but they do come through, they do survive. And so I know the ending of the novel, and it will have this formal affirmation of the human spirit. Not always, you know, and I don't mean it to be sentimental, but because it's an aesthetic structure, and I'm working each day or each hour on it, I know where it's going, so it's not so depressing.
So do you write generally by making an outline or, you know, the broad strokes of what a story is going to be, beginning, middle, and end, and then you fill it in, as opposed to writing from the beginning with a general idea and then you kind of reveal it to yourself as you go?
Well, I can't think of anybody who would write in that second way that you mentioned, though. No, that would be a recipe for real disaster. I mean, just writing, like getting in a car and just driving and not knowing where you're going. No, I would never do that. I don't think most serious writers would even think of doing that. I always know the ending. I know the last line. I know exactly what people are going to be doing in the last paragraph, the last chapter. I know the middle. I know, you know, the beginning, obviously. Sometimes the beginning and the ending are almost exact. There's some sort of parallel, but much has changed in between. Building a novel is like building a cathedral in some cases, where you have very, very many parts. You have a high ceiling, you have this, you have complications, you have an outside, you have an inside, but you always have a plan.
And do you try to end, if I understood your previous answer correctly, with affirmation, leaving people with a sense of hope? And do you think that in recent years more novels have tended to end with despair?
No, it depends on what the novel is. I would never give a corny happy ending. I don't really want to write works of fiction that are feel good, because I think that's conniving I really don't do that, and I don't read that kind of work, and I don't watch those kinds of movies. It's a situation has its own integrity. Hamlet has an ending that's violent. It's extremely tragic. There are many deaths at the end of Hamlet, and yet there is a sense of affirmation because there's going to be a new, you know, a new dispensation and a new king. And much of what I write has a younger generation coming along. The older generation may be played out. They may literally be dead. They may be dying or defeated. But there is a sense that there's a younger generation. That was the case with my novel, Them. Mm-hmm. And it's actually true in nature. It's a sort of a Darwinian fact of life. One generation may be a disaster, but there will be a younger generation, completely untested and new and with idealism. I mean, I teach university students, and it's remarkable how idealistic they are. They're extremely energetic and imaginative. And whatever we've done, whatever their older generations have done to devastate the world and the environment, the younger people still have their own hopes and their own aspirations.
Last thing, I read on the Wikipedia page about you that you moved at one point from writing your journal on a typewriter to writing mostly emails, to write what is in effect your journal, but that you still write your books longhand. Is any of that true?
Oh, I write a lot of my notes longhand. When I travel, for instance, I have huge files of pieces of paper with handwriting on them. Yeah. That's sort of the beginning. And when I do a book review, it's all handwritten first, but all sort of in fragments. You know, it doesn't start the first paragraph and end. It's all sort of broken up paragraphs. And then one day I'll sit at the computer and organize it and put it all together into something that's like a first draft.
Do you find that you write differently if you're writing longhand or in the old days on a typewriter or on word processing?
Well, I always wrote longhand. I mean, I just took it to a typewriter. But I always wrote in longhand. Many poets write in longhand.
And do you find that you do that? I'm curious if you think that you write differently when you write in longhand than when you write at a keyboard.
Oh, I don't know. These things are sort of trivial. I think people always asking, like, you write with, a pen or a pencil and so forth. I guess it's some bedrock of curiosity, but it's probably not too important.
Blue ink?
I don't think it's too much different.
Joyce Carol Oates, her new novel is called The Sacrifice. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.